Today on The Connection, Skip Heitzig talks with Dr. Walt Brown about origins and creation.
The most popular view is the creation view, believe it or not. Typically about 45% of the Americans take the creation view. God created everything essentially as it is today, less than 10,000 years ago. Only about 35 to 40% take the theistic evolution view. And here's a surprising thing. There's the atheistic evolution view, saying that we've evolved up from fish and ape-like animals and bacteria, but there was no God. It was just a natural process. That's the atheistic evolution view, and typically there's about 9 or 10% that take that view.
Welcome to The Connection with Skip Heitzig. Today, we're going to take a short break from our current series, The Bible from 30,000 Feet, as we spend some time with Skip in studio with his special guest, Dr. Walt Brown. Dr. Brown is a graduate of MIT and holds a PhD in mechanical engineering. He's also a West Point graduate and a retired colonel of the U.S. Air Force. He's taught courses in physics, mathematics, and computer sciences. For almost three decades, he has firmly stated that when it comes to the debate over the origins of our planet, one should confine that debate within the limits of scientific evidence. Dr. Brown will explain exactly what that means in today's interview, but before we get started, we'd like to recommend an excellent resource that will help equip you to intelligently discuss this issue of evolution and creation. In Dr. Brown's book, In the Beginning, he outlines the scientific evidence that supports the biblical account of creation and the flood. And you can order this informative text for just $30, plus $5 shipping and handling, when you call 1-800-922-1888, or when you visit connectionradio.org. Although he began as an evolutionist, Dr. Brown eventually realized that the evidence doesn't support that theory. And we'll hear more about why he thinks that as Skip Heitzig chats with Dr. Walt Brown today here on The Connection.
Take the time.
The debate over where we came from and how this world and this universe began is an intense one. So let's join Skip Heitzig and Dr. Walt Brown as they talk about which side of the debate the evidence best supports.
Let's just jump right into creation, Walt. This is a huge hot button, seems to always have been. Tell us what's going on. Are there any national trends that we need to be aware of concerning creation and evolution?
Not really. The Gallup people conduct polls every couple of years on this issue. They ask a very perceptive question. They say, what is your belief about creation or evolution? There are typically four views. One of them says that God created everything essentially as it is today, roughly 10,000 years ago or less. That I would call the creation view. The theistic evolution view is that God created all right, did it billions of years ago, and we've evolved up from lower animals up to where we are today, but God guided the process. That's the theistic evolution view. You probably have some people in your church, Skip, that have that view.
There are a lot of them that have the... Why do you feel that that is such a touted view? Why do some people feel the need to accommodate to the...
Because we have grown up, we've all grown up in a society that is bombarded by the idea that things are billions of years old. Mm-hmm. And it's you pay attention this week, and in the media, newspapers, television, radio, you will hear something talking about, well, these dinosaurs were roaming the Earth 65 million years ago.
Exactly.
Or this meteorite, this meteor shower came from a comet that's 4 billion years old. But the most popular view is the creation view, believe it or not. Typically about 45% of the Americans take the creation view. God created everything essentially as it is today, less than 10,000 years ago. Only about 35 to 40% take the theistic evolution view. And here's a surprising thing. There's the atheistic evolution view, saying that we've evolved up from fish and ape-like animals and bacteria. But there was no God. It was just a natural process. That's the atheistic evolution view. And typically, there's about 9 or 10% that take that view. What is surprising is that's what's taught in our schools, the public schools at least, and many Christian schools.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's a minority.
Interesting, because that's the squeaky wheel. That's where the books that are written, the films that get shown, seems to be this minority view.
Yeah, yeah. And you'll have rocks thrown at you if you espouse the other view, especially even if you espouse it from a strictly scientific point of view. And I maintain that I can defend a young Earth view scientifically. And I don't think anybody in the world is going to want to take me up on the challenge. In the book that you've got that I wrote a year and a half ago, I have a challenge in there. It's an offer for a debate. If anybody has read the explanation I give for the flood, it's called the hydroplate theory, and disagrees with it, we can have a debate on the phone. It will be monitored by a professional debater from some university, a moderator of an advisor of some debate organization. We'll select it at random. There's a way to do it fairly. It'll be tape recorded. It'll be transcribed. It can be put up at websites. There's no takers, Skip. Mm.
Well, Walt, you stunned me a few years ago when you made that challenge to have a publicly televised debate here in New Mexico, and that you would give your transcript out in advance of what you were going to say, and we couldn't get a single person to take you up on it.
Yeah, about once a year, when I would do the traveling and speaking, about once a year, somebody that was hosting me, and I gave that offer to every host, if you want to set up an oral debate, I'm happy to do it. I'll stay an extra day, and we'll do it. And I'll let the evolutionists a month ahead of time know exactly what I'm going to say.
Hmm. Wow. Hey, let's go to this little theory that you brought up that is pretty prevalent right now, and that is the age of the Earth. If I walk into a natural history museum and I see a dinosaur fossil, there'll be some sign that says these creatures roamed the Earth 40 million years ago, and they base it on carbon dating. How accurate? What do we need to know about carbon dating?
Well, first of all, they'll say the dinosaurs lived 65 million years ago or older. Mm-hmm. They say they were all wiped out 65 million years ago. And radiocarbon will not date back that far. Radiocarbon only dates back maybe 70,000 years. There are other radiometric dating techniques that can date back in the millions of years if you buy into their assumptions. And radiocarbon has its own assumptions.
Hmm.
Most people don't know what these assumptions are.
Right. What are they? Can you do it in layman's terms?
I can give it very quickly. It's a bigger subject than we're able to handle here. But the key assumption in radiocarbon dating is that the concentration of radiocarbon, it's called carbon-14, that concentration of radiocarbon to normal carbon, carbon-12, has always been the same as it is today. And if it wasn't, if, for example, the flood altered it drastically, and I'll show you why that would happen. I mean, if we have a half an hour to talk, if the flood altered it, it'll throw those radiocarbon dates way out of whack. Now, radiocarbon dating is an excellent dating technique as long as you don't go back beyond about 3,000, maybe 3,500 years.
Wow.
But in that range, it's an excellent dating technique. There are ways of cross-checking it. But when you get back toward the time of the flood, about 5,000 years ago, give or take 700 years, when you get back toward the flood, those assumptions break down horribly.
And so here you have a dating process that is only accurate up to 3,000 years old, and yet they're tagging all sorts of ages that go beyond thousands into the millions of years.
Yeah, the radiocarbon will not go back beyond about 70,000 years, if you buy their assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't buy their assumptions, but But then you have uranium to lead, potassium to argon dating, argon-argon dating, rubidium-strontium dating. They all lean on another assumption, those dating techniques I mentioned, namely that the rate of radioactive decay has always been the same as it is today.
Mm-hmm.
What if at the time of the flood, and I can show you if you want to read a very technical paper that I've written, I can show you that at the time of the flood, the Earth's radioactive characteristics were formed very rapidly.
Interesting.
And if you didn't know that, and you saw all these daughter products, uranium decays, mm-hmm. and eventually uranium atom becomes a lead atom. And if all these daughter products, such as lead, were formed very quickly and in the process of generating this radioactive material, you might foolishly think that it has been building up at the slow rate it is today.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mistake.
And you're saying the rate has not been the same?
No. And what you have to do is ask this question. And you won't hear this question asked very much. In fact, I've never heard it asked. What is the origin of Earth's radioactivity?
Right.
And now, if you're an evolutionist, you say, well, the origin of everything was the Big Bang. Big Bang produced three chemical elements, hydrogen, helium, and a little bit of lithium. Well, what happened to the other 100 elements, including uranium, or potassium, or argon? Well, that's another little bit of a problem. They say, well, in stars, you can produce maybe the lightest 26 or 27 of them. And I'm not going to argue about that. But how do you get the heavier ones? They don't know, Skip. They honestly don't know.
So if they don't know that, and yet they're telling us how old the Earth is. In fact, what do evolutionists say the age of the Earth is?
4.6 billion years.
And based on what?
They base it on the radiometric dating process of meteorites. Meteorites are the oldest known things on Earth. When a meteor slams into the Earth, its name is changed from meteor to meteorite.
Mm-hmm.
And they have certain radioactive particles in them that give off daughter products. And when you measure those, you see there's been more radioactive decay in those meteorites than anything else on Earth. Right. I agree. There's been a lot of radioactive decay there. But it happened as a consequence of the flood. And the flood not only launched the fountains of the great deep, and underline those words, the fountains of the great deep, all the fountains of the great deep broke loose, it launched material into space that later converged and formed meteors, comets, and asteroids.
Now, that makes sense, because the kind of pressure we're talking about to open up the fountains of the, to open up the crust of the Earth,
right,
and spew material into space, what kind of volume are we talking about?
We're talking about roughly half the volume of our oceans under the crust of the Earth. The pressure building up, and there's a very interesting explanation for why that is happening, why that happened. But when the Apollo 13 mission went to the moon, They discovered something. The astronauts threw waste material overboard on the way to the moon, and they thought they were rid of it. But it continued to orbit the spacecraft. And they didn't know why. And they got back to Earth, and they figured it out. Well, it turned out several centuries earlier, a French mathematician, Lagrange, figured it all out, wrote it up. But they figured out what was happening. Well, if you're sitting on Earth here, next to that spacecraft, you don't feel its gravity because the Earth's gravity dominates.
Right.
But if you're away from the Earth and next to that spacecraft, the spacecraft's gravity is the only game in town.
I got it.
So it will orbit. So when you launch rocks, water molecules, and dust and debris up into space, those larger rocks, their gravity becomes the only game in town. And if particles are moving at about the same speed and direction as that big rock, material is going to start to spiral into that rock. Just the way a spacecraft coming back to the Earth, when it hits the Earth's atmosphere, it decays. It's called aerobraking, and it settles into down to the Earth. Well, that's what happens. There's a sphere of influence, it's called, around every object in the universe. And the further away this object is from a large gravity body, the larger its sphere of influence. It can control, it can, in effect, capture a moon or another particle, a satellite, to bring it in.
Hmm.
So that's how I have a chapter in the book dealing just with the origin of comets.
Hmm.
And I have another chapter dealing just with the origin of asteroids. And you'll see that all the characteristics you can think of those kinds of bodies, are explained as a consequence of the flood, the fountains of the great deep.
Well, let's go to one of the most typical questions that is on the minds of younger people, and really older people, but I think younger people ask it more, and that is about dinosaurs. Huh? Walt, in the biblical timeline, where do dinosaurs fit in?
The Bible speaks of dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. Dinosaurs were created about the same time as man, during the creation week, for sure. And they were living before the flood. The book of Job describes, chapter 40, verse 15, describes an animal called Behemoth. From chapter 40, verse 15 on to the end, it describes this animal called Behemoth. It ate huge volumes of food. The only animal that I know that fits that description is a dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
And don't pay much attention to the marginal notes in your Bible.
Yes.
Because it'll probably say, well, it was an elephant. Elephants don't have tails like cedars.
Yep.
Some will say, well, it was a hippopotamus. The same thing with the problem with the hippopotamus. No tail like a cedar. You go to the next chapter, chapter 41, it speaks of Leviathan. Whole chapter is about Leviathan. It's a sea-growing monster. Well, they were living. They've become extinct. Almost all of them died out at the time of the flood. So, yeah, and yes, dinosaurs would have been on the ark. I wouldn't have put a large dinosaur on it. I'd put a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Baby brontosaurus egg or a brontosaurus egg. You can hold like a basketball or medicine ball, something like that. So dinosaurs were there before the flood. Most of them died out as a consequence. There were great changes in the Earth's environment as a consequence of the flood.
Mm-hmm.
Major mountains were pushed up. Began to rain after the flood.
Yeah.
Right after the flood, it did not rain.
Walt, isn't it true that the evolutionist will put the age of dinosaurs and the age of man at different epochs, different eras?
Yeah, yeah.
But isn't there evidence, and didn't I read that even down in Texas, there's evidence of footprints of man close to or even embedded into that of a dinosaur?
Yeah, you've read that, and I've been there three times. there's a big question mark over that site. It's the Plexi Riverbed near Glen Rose, Texas. I'm not going to come down one side or the other, except to say that some of those footprints that look like humans probably were the middle toe of a three-toed dinosaur.
Huh.
Going, I believe it's slightly downhill.
Huh.
Now, there have been other places where it looks as if you see human prints next to dinosaur prints. And think of the dragon legends. What do dragons remind you of? When you read these dragon stories, and there are dragon stories or artwork in almost every ancient culture.
Hmm.
Don't they remind you of dinosaurs?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've got authorities who specialize in dragon legends, and they say, well, if we didn't know the dinosaurs became extinct 65 million years before man evolved, we would just have to say the dinosaurs are the source of these dragon legends.
Hmm.
But no, there were dinosaurs, all right. And man knew them, and the Bible speaks of them, Behemoth.
Mm-hmm.
And very consistent with what the Bible says and what we know scientifically.
Yes.
The dinosaurs did not die out 65 million years ago. That's a myth.
Okay.
The dinosaurs died out primarily at the time of the flood. There are a few that probably survived it after. But the flood was about 5,000 years ago. And because people do not understand the flood, Even most church leaders don't understand the flood. Because they don't understand the flood, they have to start accepting some of these evolutionary ideas.
Let's talk about the difference between uniformitarianism, and which even Peter warns about, and that of being a catastrophist, which you are. I mean, you're saying that at one point this earth was dramatically changed so that what is apparent now was not apparent then. Talk about the difference between those two things, Walt, and what would the consequence be if you're a true uniformitarianist?
Well, when the field of geology was developing, let's say 1800, they were making some discoveries, and there were a lot of Christians that were talking about the flood and it, in not a very sound scientific way. And Charles Lyell, who's considered the father of geology, said, we're going to build this science on the assumption that the process, the rates we see things happening today, the rate at which mountains erode, or the Grand Canyon gets deeper, or mountains rise or shift, we're going to assume that those rates have always been what they are today. That's called uniformitarianism. And if you thought the Grand Canyon was being carved an inch every century, and you took the height to the depth of the Grand Canyon, about a mile, and you divided it by an inch per century, you'd come up with millions of years. That's assuming a rate. Well, the flood wasn't a rate going on at the way things are today. It was a cataclysm. In fact, the Hebrew word for the Greek word for flood is cataclysmos. It was a cataclysm. It wasn't just the kind of flood that you read about in Bangladesh.
Right. Nothing
it was
local.
A cataclysm. All the fountains of the great deep broke loose. Billions of hydrogen bombs worth of energy were released in those 40 days of continual rain. It was the fountains of the great deep breaking loose, and then that water coming back down as a spray. And that's probably a poor use of the word spray, but that's where the rains began after the fountains of the Great Deep broke loose. When the fountains of the Great Deep were closed up, the rain stopped. That's what the Bible says.
Yeah. So, Walt, here you are. You've been trained at MIT and in the Army, etc. What you're talking about, a discrimination, intellectual discrimination. You must have seen it and must have experienced it in your lifetime. Tell us about that.
Well, really, I haven't personally. Many people have.
Yep.
You may have seen the film Expelled.
Right. Exactly.
And one of the people featured in there was out here in Phoenix and spent an evening with her, Dr. Carolyn Crocker. She's been greatly discriminated against, but I haven't. See, I taught at the Air Force Academy.
Oh, I see.
And I was a lieutenant colonel. And, yeah, there were a couple of evolutionists in our department, and they probably didn't like the idea that I was a creationist. I didn't talk about it that much. If somebody asked me, I'd discuss it. But they weren't going to give me any trouble.
Well, Walter Brown, it's just been great talking with you. Thank you for your time.
I enjoyed being with you, Skip.
Your book is tremendous. There's so much, not only information and facts and figures, but inspiration. I mean, it gives to readers that sure foundation of that the Bible is exactly as it's purported to be, the Word of Truth.
It's an exciting subject, and the effect it had on me, coming from evolution, being an evolutionist, is it made the Bible come alive. It wasn't this vague sort of thing that happened billions of years ago. It came alive.
Beautiful.
And the accuracy was phenomenal that I found in the Bible. Phenomenal.
Well, thank you for your time, Dr. Brown. God bless you.
Thank you, Skip.
Thanks for joining us for this special First Friday presentation of The Connection with Skip Heitzig and Dr. Walt Brown. That's all the time we have for today. But before we go, if you'd like to read more from Dr. Brown, you can order his text, In the Beginning, for just $30 plus $5 shipping and handling when you call 1-800-922-1888. As we heard, Dr. Brown believes one should simply examine the evidence in order to decide how life began. And in his book, he explains why the evidence does a better job to support the Bible's account of creation and the flood than it does evolution. Order your copy today by calling 1-800-922-1888 or visit connectionradio.org. You can also write us at The Connection. That's P.O. Box 95707, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87199.
Take the time to make the connection. Take the time to make the connection.
Next time on The Connection, Skip Heitzig continues our series, The Bible from 30,000 Feet. So join us as we resume our journey through the entire Bible here on The Connection, a presentation of Connection Communications, connecting you to God's never-changing truth in ever-changing times.